We know there is a direct correlation between smoking tobacco and lung cancer. Walk into any convenience store and you are warned of that very loudly and very boldly. We also know that smoking cannabis can lead to cardiovascular problems such as arrhythmias, heart attacks, and strokes. But what we don't know is how not smoking cannabis and using it in other ways affects the heart, at least in relation to causing these serious cardiovascular complications. It seems if you are not smoking weed, cannabis use has many surprising positive cardiovascular effects. In this episode, we will be loving on cannabis for its potential to reduce complications and diseases associated with the heart. Welcome to this episode of Cannabis Nurse Truths, where today we share heart-healthy cannabis and how to keep your heart safe during cannabis use.
It is episode number 14 of Cannabis Nurse Truths. Welcome back. New episodes every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts. Visit the website, CannabisNurseTruths.com. Follow us on the social media zizzes. Just search for at Canna Podcast. That's CannaPotCast. And in particular, follow us on X to stay up with the latest. I'm Lee Foster, and she's Dr. Denise Foster. We're talking about matters of the heart on this episode of Cannabis Nurse Truths.
We're seeing population growth in cardiovascular disorders and in even worldwide. So cardiovascular disease is the number one killer worldwide. Let's see, 18.6 million deaths from cardiovascular disease in 2019. And this is a number that is climbing not only in the United States, it is also climbing across the globe as more and more countries adopt unheart healthy diets. Because the leading cause of these cardiovascular diseases is the atherosclerotic heart disease, the atherosclerotic plaques that embed themselves in arteries. And in most cases, these arteries are either, you know, covering the heart, those are coronary arteries, or they're leading to the heart with very big pressures. And this is why cardiovascular disease begins with hypertension, high blood pressure. And then over time, that high blood pressure, it's a closed loop. And when you put too much pressure in that closed loop, you're going to increase the damage to the tissues. So when we think about how it's the leading cause of morbidity and damage to the society at large, think of the societal impact of caring for these large amounts of cardiovascular disorders, all associated with atherosclerosis, that's high cholesterol. In 2020, in the United States, more than 20 million have a cardiovascular disease. 20 million Americans.
Wow.
That's 20% of all deaths. That's one-fifth of all deaths in the United States. How long have we been talking about heart attacks and strokes and high blood pressure and high cholesterol? We've been talking about these ever since I graduated from nursing school. And does it seem that it's gotten better? I think with 20% of the people across the United States dying from cardiovascular disease, it doesn't seem that we're making any progress in this area.
Does it all go back to our poor diets at times, lack of exercise? Could it have something to do with drug use or addiction to opiates?
It's definitely multifactorial. We do know that the American diets have changed significantly, drastically.
Yes.
Processed food, food portions, the types of foods that are available. Then you add on the social types of problems. For instance, if you're a working mom and you've got soccer practice and kids to feed and dad is working too, you're going to pick up that fast food very quickly and then you're going to feed it to your kids. I'm of the generation where soda pop was a luxury. We didn't have liters of soda in our refrigerator. We had all of the water was number one. Get it from the faucet, get it from the hose, and then you had tea, lemonade, maybe some juices thrown in there. Coffee was a mainstay.
Yep.
Adults drank coffee all day long. So this generation, and we're seeing the effects roll into this from the increases and the prevalence of the cardiovascular disorders. And this is not something that's an easy fix. So the multi-factors include all of those things like diet, exercise. Those are the modifiable risk factors. Unmodifiable risk factors, genetics, you know, metabolism, sometimes culture. A lot of culture drives cardiovascular disease. We study intently cultures that are both very lean. For instance, in Asian culture, they eat a lot of protein in fish. They don't eat a lot of the complex carbohydrates. They only eat things like rice and very minimal carb amounts. So comparing cultural differences is also important. And we know that Americans are very unhealthy now because of this. And the numbers don't lie. The concern with this is that it's not getting better. And then when you add on unknown factors that could complicate things like cannabis, we weren't sure what cannabis effects would have on cardiovascular disease. And that's a concern because associated with the cardiovascular disease is the age-related changes in people that are normally associated with this cardiovascular problems. More older people, we assume, get the heart attacks. More older people get the strokes. More older people have high blood pressure and high cholesterol. So this is why we need to understand the older adults, because they're the fastest growing group using medical marijuana. They're the fastest growing group in the United States. In the 20 million Americans that have cardiovascular disorders, over 800,000 have experienced an MI. MI is a myocardial infarction. That's the medical term, clinical term for heart attack. And numerous studies to date have shown that the pathology outcomes, meaning mortality, pathology, pathological means bad outcomes. The bad outcomes of smoking marijuana are the consequences that can particularly drive these heart attacks, these strokes, these embolisms, etc. So we have mixed findings regarding the cardiovascular effects of marijuana use. Because up till this point, really in our clinical history or clinical research associated with marijuana, we've used smoking as the primary modality method of administration. That's all we had up until recently. Up until recently, the only place you could get your weed was from the back alley or from your friend, someone you knew who knew someone. And the only way to get that would be in a flower form to smoke. So we still don't really understand from a scientific perspective, from an overall population perspective. Now that we have additional modalities, methods of administration, oils, edibles like gummies, brownies, cookies, people love to bake with their cannabis oil. And then you throw in the other cannabinoids that we now are understanding have beneficial properties, like CBD. We don't know how this is going to play out, and we are just now starting to develop the studies. We need to specifically educate our clinicians. I'm a cardiovascular nurse at heart, a cardiac nurse at heart. I love the fact that when you understand the cardiovascular system and then you tie it to everything else, it the cardiovascular system is the workhorse.
It's the engine.
It's the engine of the heart.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the engine of the body. I think of the central nervous system as the CPU unit of the body, right? You need power to run the CPU, but the CPU is what gives you your output.
Makes sense, yeah.
So if you think of it from a perspective that if we want to understand heart diseases to cannabis use, now that more Americans are either accessing it, they have access to it in 37 states now, or they are already using it. We know they're already using it. We need to understand the underlying causes of what was driving the research before. So we're not going to discount that. We have to understand that there are risks, and the risks associate typically with smoking, but we also want to know how things are going to play out as more and more Americans are using cannabis.
With more and more people, Dr. D, turning to cannabis in its various forms, you mentioned this is something that has needed to be studied. We do have some studies. We do have some data that we can look at right now. What are we seeing?
The endocannabinoid system that we've discussed before on our podcast has an incredible role in helping us balance our body. Our body is in a state always of trying to move from wellness to illness and beyond. So when we think of that state, we think of mind, body, spirit medicine. You have to know anxiety, low stress, being able to sleep, you know, you're upbeat, you're feeling good physically wise. So when you think of what the endocannabinoid system does, it is not surprising that the endocannabinoid system also will balance the diseases related to cardiovascular disease, CVD, because they're either involved in the pathology of it, meaning that they are actually causing it, surprise, or they are actually reversing the damage and then preventing it from occurring again. The mechanisms of these opposite actions, either damaging to the cardiovascular system or protecting it, are really driven by the two receptors, the cannabinoid receptor 1 and the cannabinoid receptor 2. What differs them is their placement. Cannabinoid receptor 1 is typically found mainly in the central nervous system. This actually explains many of the effects for when you use a cannabinoid receptor 1 agonist. And an agonist, in medical terms, is something that stimulates, provokes, and elicits a response from a receptor. So an agonist is going to stimulate this cannabinoid 1 receptor in the central nervous system, whereas the cannabinoid 2 receptor is typically found in the immune system and other tissues throughout the body. And in this particular response, the cannabinoid 2 system actually is a cardiovascular protectant. It protects in many different ways because the CB2 receptor is actually tied to the immune and inflammatory response. We've talked about that before in relation to how it protects against COVID. So the mechanism of this dual dynamic effects is almost a reason for why the system has eluded us for so long. Is that we're so used to seeing people who have pathological states from smoking cannabis, because that's what stimulates the receptors in the brain gets disoriented when you smoke cannabis. When the brain gets disoriented, because now the THC, which is the intoxicating cannabinoid, stimulates the CB1 receptor in the brain responds with a fight or flight effect. Therefore, the heart rate goes up. If you have an arrhythmia, a dysrhythmia, like AFib, A-flutter, that could provoke a very dangerous situation. If you have a clot from cholesterol or a clot hiding out somewhere in the, or stenosis, a narrowed artery somewhere in the heart vessels, that could be a problem that could trigger a heart attack. So this is why we have to understand both the positives and the negatives. On the other side, the endocannabinoid system is thought to be a therapeutic target for many cardiovascular disorders, hypertension, atherosclerosis, the high cholesterol, even cardiomyopathy. Cardiomyopathy has made the news lately because of a certain injection, and people are looking for ways to reverse the inflammation associated with cardiomyopathy. It also has been shown to be beneficial for treatment before and after heart attacks. So when we're looking at how the endocannabinoid system will provide both a beneficial effect or a risky effect, we have to understand the effects based at the receptor level.
So if it could possibly cause harm, but it also could possibly be useful and helpful, how do we approach it? In what way do we use it? What parameters do we put around it to make sure that people are benefiting from it? Because obviously we don't want to see people get hurt.
No. We're going to talk about a call to action about how it's really an issue of screening and understanding the population using cannabis, and then the modality, and then the number of the cannabinoids, the types of cannabinoids being used in that modality. It's a science, and science is really providing us a lot of good foundational data that is both reliable and valid. We're hitting the target because we're now able to study from a scientific level, a clinical level, like we do in all research, and not think of it as a bad thing anymore. We're looking to see, well, what does it do in the body? Just instead of saying, oh, bad weed, local weed, bad. That's not the good thing.
Right.
And we've talked before about how studies have shown that weed is bad because we've studied very bad weed and looked for the dangers Whereas these receptor effects have been hidden to us because we've been using just weed, which is compiled mostly of THC. That's the compound in question.
Weed is bad. Okay.
Okay.
More on the differences between the receptors.
Yeah, the receptors are where the cool activities come from. Well, cool depending on where the receptor lies. With the CB1 receptor, the cannabinoid 1 receptor, is mainly found in the brain, but it is also found in the cardiac muscle. It is also found in the blood vessel tissue, and it is also found in the smooth muscle cells of different tissues. So when we think about how you stimulate the cannabinoid 1 receptor in the central nervous system, now you're talking the negative effects associated with cannabis. When we stimulate the cannabinoid 1 receptor, typically using THC, because THC is the cannabinoid 1 receptor stimulator, it creates a negative rate response, meaning that the heart rate will increase in response to this altered mentation. Think about when you're on a boat. Anybody who gets seasick can tell you, once that brain begins to rock and roll, I don't want to make anybody seasick, but once that visual connection begins to affect the brain, you begin to feel the effects of that. So the brain is very sensitive to changes in mentation, and then the euphoric effects of the THC is what is now stimulating the cannabinoid 1 receptor for the negative effects. The tachycardia, the rate increases. The strength of the contraction, we call this the inotropic effect. The rate, the strength. So every stroke of your heart, so your heartbeat is whatever it is, right? 60 to 100 times per minute. If you're an athlete, super athlete, maybe it's 40. I don't know. But every heartbeat, you have to squeeze out the volume of blood to perfuse every tissue in your body. That's a lot of squeeze. So when you squeeze every time, you are now strongly squirting out volumes of blood through all of the system, including the chambers of the heart. And I used to teach that the heart is a greedy organ, and it demands its oxygenated blood first, because blood coming from the heart is oxygenated, and the coronary arteries want their blood first. So they get the majority, they get a large amount for their size of the coronary blood that is oxygenated so that it can reperfuse the heart. Reperfuse is putting fresh oxygenated blood into the tissues so that the venous system can carry it away. When we think about how the CB1 receptor gets activated, we now know that the more THC you use, the more it's going to alter that mentation, that CB1 receptor stimulation. And that's where the dangers are now associated, because if you raise the heart rate, now we're concerned about arrhythmias. If you raise the heart inotropic squeeze, the pressure coming out of the heart, now we're at risk of either dislodging a clot if there's an atherosclerotic plaque somewhere that's going to travel, or we're worried about stenosis, meaning that you think about a hose that gets crimped. You've pushed so much through that little stenotic area, that little constricted blood vessel, that you could burst it. This is where we get an aneurysm from, pressure inside a very weakened wall of the artery, and atherosclerosis weakens our arterial walls. So understanding that we don't want to stimulate the cannabinoid receptor 1 in the brain, usually the only compound that we would do that is THC. So the best thing to do would be to antagonize or to not use the cannabinoid receptor 1, which would mean avoid THC. When we don't use the CB1 receptor, we actually improve cardiac function after myocardial infarction and metabolic syndrome. We found in a few studies that inhibition of this CB1 receptor lessens hypertension and tachycardia after someone has used cannabis. So the moral of the story is those individuals using THC should A, not be smoking it, or vaping it, because I do believe that vaping will still give the same tachycardic effect. Not smoking it, they should be using alternative methods of delivery, and they also should be using it in low doses. until they understand their effects on the heart, especially in relation to those older adults. While the CB1 receptor is found in the central and peripheral nervous systems, along with the gut-brain axis, the CB2 receptor is found everywhere else. So it's interesting to see the differences in these overall effects in the body. In physiological conditions, meaning when the body is balanced in its wellness, well-being, you're low in anxiety, you sleep well, you feel uplifted and energized and motivated, you don't have any major physical disorders.
You just feel good.
You just feel good. The CB receptor expression, meaning the presence of these receptors, because they come and go, they're made on demand by the body. The CB2 receptors are very low in their numbers in a physiological state, meaning that if you're well, there's no need for these CB2 receptors to show up on the scene. However, in disease states, we call this the pathological condition, in disease states, CB2 receptors begin to appear. And why is that? We're thinking that because they are related to the immune cells and the inflammatory response, they show up when inflammation hits the body. And all diseases begin as inflammation. And inflammation is oxidative stress. And what does the government own? The patent on cannabinoids as antioxidants and neuroprotectants. Hello? They knew what they were doing. In the pathological conditions, the CB2 receptor cells are really indicative of pathological states. This is very interesting because we may be able to develop some diagnostic testing on the number of CB2 receptors in your body and maybe even dial it down to where they're located, where they're we call this upregulation, where there's more numbers of them. And that would help us correlate or maybe even pinpoint a disease state in a specific tissue. In all pathological conditions, the CB2 receptors are upregulated. There's way more of them. So we think that in states of disease where disease is absent, including cardiovascular disease, the CB2 receptors are helping to protect the cardiovascular system in many different ways. I got a couple studies here that show how the CB2 receptor plays a cardioprotective role, especially in ischemic reperfusion injury. Reperfusion injury was a surprise to us because as we began getting more research and understanding of how we can help the heart after, for instance, heart attack or heart transplant, that was a wild one. That happened, you know, in Norfolk in my lifetime. We also were surprised that when we reflood those tissues with fresh oxygenated blood, that's what it needs, it actually creates more stress on those tissues. And we call this a reperfusion injury, where there's more oxygen demand because of this flooding and the tissues that were kind of, they were in a starvation state, an ischemic state for oxygen. Then they were flooded with oxygen, and this is called a reperfusion injury. And we're finding that the expression of these CB2 receptors actually can help because it is anti-apoptotic. Apoptosis is the process of cell suicide. So these CB2 receptors in this condition will prevent the cells from dying. They are anti-fibrogenic, meaning that it prevents fibrogen from forming, and fibrogen is the beginning of a blood clot or atherosclerotic plaque. And they also have anti-hypertrophic effects. Hypertrophy is growth of the cell. The cell gets bigger. And we know that hypertrophy of the heart is associated with things like cardiomyopathy and heart failure and things that make the heart grow larger. Using the CB2 receptor and activity, we can actually help repair the heart after damage and even in the most severe conditions like these reperfusion injuries. Fascinating stuff.
We have all these benefits, but then we also have all these risks that go along with it. So what's the way to get at it safely, I guess, is what I'm thinking.
You have to understand which cannabinoids will do what, and then back to the mode of administration. Smoking is going to give you, and vaping is going to give you that immediate CB1 receptor activation in the brain. Activation of the CB1 receptor is going to be the problem here because that's the one that's going to create the alterations in the mentation. The nauseous effect, we can call it, where you get that, you start to feel, ooh, I don't like how I feel now. that feeling of wooziness, that feeling of being at a high euphoric state that your brain does not like, and that's different for every individual. Not every individual gets seasick. Some are very sensitive to changes in balance. And so when that altered mentation occurs, that's where the CB1 receptor is activated that kicks the body into that fight or flight. If we want to avoid the negative effects of cannabis, we would not smoke it. The byproducts of smoking itself, combustion, are going to release toxic gases, nitric oxide, carbon monoxide. So these are things that will also affect not only the oxygen demand, but also can trigger things like spasming in those endothelial tissues, the smooth muscles of the blood vessels.
Okay, so it actually is pretty simple. Avoid smoking it, which we already know the dangers of smoking to begin with.
That's right, because walk into any convenience store and you see the dangers of smoking tobacco.
Right.
Warning, the Surgeon General has found that this is directly correlated to cancer.
Right.
So when you buy yourself a pack of them smokes from tobacco, it's really... We're finding that the plant material, the tobacco is not really as much of the problem. It's the byproducts from the processing and packaging of the tobacco, and then the combusting of those compounds. It's the same with cannabis. While there have been some very opposing studies that we have mixed results from that say either cannabis does cause lung cancer or promote cancer, or it does not cause lung cancer or promote cancer, again, the jury is still out, because the things that we have focused on in research to date have mainly focused on smoking marijuana. You can't get valid empirical data from one set of a population over a decade of trending. We're just at the beginning of processes of developing our understanding of how to use it appropriately.
We need more research.
We do know already that smoking cannabis is bad, and we've known that for the 80 years of research we've done. We have study after study that shows smoking cannabis can result in atrial fibrillation, ventricle fibrillation, tachycardia, dysrhythmias like premature ventricular contractions and premature atrial contractions. However, when we looked at a very large population, this was a study in 2023 by Teruoka. This particular study found no statistically significant difference in incidences of atrial fibrillation among users of cannabis in a large longitudinal cohort. The limitation in this study, I do know that was that they did not tease out cannabis smoking from other modes of administration. But since the study was done in 2023, we're going to have to assume that in this population, there were mixed methods of administration. There was some smoking, but more than likely, there were also edibles and oils and other ways of using it as well. So this, while it's a flawed study, overall, it did demonstrate that other modalities do not increase your risk of developing a dysrhythmia. That's, again, where we need more research. We now need to begin understanding, how do edibles work on atrial fibrillation over a long period of time? Do they have a difference? Because we know that the smoking causes these problems. The dizziness associated with smoking cannabis also causes a problem, because smoking it as a vapor is going to immediately fill up that brain cell cavity. It's going to go right into that brain. It's going to begin having effects sometimes as early as 2 minutes. Especially in our older population who may have even more sensitivities to the changes in the brain cell activation. So the hypotension and the tachycardia that are concerning, along with the loss of mentation, the decision-making, the balance, the feelings of dizziness, these are where the dangers fall. And the risks are really associated mainly with the smoking or vaping of THC in those individuals who may already be at risk for cardiovascular disorder.
Cannabis Nurse Truths is brought to you by Hemp Haven Wellness. Let's face it, hemp is complex, coming in several different forms. You probably have many questions about the differences between cannabis and hemp, and why hemp can be used in numerous ways to treat well-being. At Hemp Haven, they have the knowledge and expertise to guide your selection of hemp-derived products to meet your wellness needs. Hemp Haven is owned and operated by America's cannabis nurse, Dr. Denise Foster. With Hemphaven, fight insomnia, relieve headaches, relieve pain, improve your mood, promote relaxation, and more. Visit Hemphaven in Chesapeake at 480 Kempsville Road, or visit them online at hemphavenwellness.com. That's hemphavenwellness.com. For the highest quality and safest products on the market, you want Hemphaven Wellness. And now on to the positive effects.
Positive effects of cannabis are now just overwhelmingly showing us that if you avoid THC, you're golden. You're golden. Don't smoke it. And really, the only reason that you would smoke is really to get the THC effect. That's why people will smoke cannabis, is to get that immediate feeling of euphoria. That's your younger subset. The older subsets are now switching to things like edibles and oil. And it is the older subset of the population, the older adults, that are actually experiencing the majority of the cardiovascular disorders. Therefore, they have the most to gain from safe education and use to cannabis products to do many things. Hypertension is everywhere. One of the most significant things I found at the end of my clinical practice in the community was that every single one of my patients, every day, 365 days a year, was on an antihypertensive med. Maybe several. Several. Because where we used to just have maybe one or two categories of antihypertensive, we now have a boatload of them. And we just, if one's not working, well, maybe four more might work better.
It's the same thing we've done with every other condition, pretty much, right?
That's
just
right.
Toss a pill at it.
Toss a pill at it. It correlates, too, with the understanding of the physiology. As our research is getting better at identifying what we call signals, especially how the body works,
right,
understanding we're getting down to the receptor level and the micro level of the cells. When we understand how cardiovascular disease function, it all starts, really, with inflammation in the blood vessels. And inflammation is tied mainly to atherosclerotic plaques. Could be tied to stress, anxiety, things that will create a high blood pressure over time. But again, if you're practicing in a well-being model, you know, you're doing mindfulness practice or meditation practice, you're managing your anxiety and your stress, you're having recreation and doing things that help mitigate stress, because everybody's going to have stress. It's what do you do with the stress that creates the issue. And hypertension could be an outcome of mental and physical, but we know that the main driver is inflammation in the blood vessels causing atherosclerosis. So those two conditions are usually tied together. And again, empirically, we know that atherosclerosis leads to high blood pressure. And for me, anecdotally, I know that every single one of my patients who was on that antihypertensive medicine was also on an anti-cholesterol medicine.
Uh-huh.
These two go hand in hand.
Yes.
Hand in hand.
And they don't fix the problem either.
And they never fix the problem.
The symptoms.
They absolutely do. They're a band-aid. And they really, over time, have shown that they are becoming more dangerous, more risky than beneficial. There was a study just released recently about the dangers of statins. And we're coming to that data now after four decades of use of statins that cause many terrible conditions. When we want to think about both atherosclerosis and hypertension together, there are several compounds in the cannabis plant that are not THC that work to either reduce blood pressure or reduce the development of atherosclerotic plaques and reverse the presence of atherosclerotic plaques. I think this is why the pharmaceutical companies are scared, because using small amounts of these compounds will actually be beneficial for hypertension. Let's see. I'm going to quote off some studies here, because we don't do anything unless it's evidence-based in healthcare, or that's how it used to be. I don't know how it is now. But we have several studies over the last several years, and I'm talking a very condensed period of time now that we're able to study cannabis as a drug of wellness. CBD reduces blood pressure, and it does this by relaxing the blood vessels. Remember those CB2 receptors that are found in the endothelial tissues in the smooth muscle cells of the blood vessels? When the CB2 receptors are stimulated and they are humming along with CBD, it will actually reduce the blood pressure by opening up that diameter of that vessel. So now we have relaxed the closed loop known as the blood vessels, and we now know that a larger dilation is going to drop a blood pressure. In one study, this was a study done by Abu Hasira in 2021. This was done in Israel, where they gave older adults, of course, those are the ones at most risk for hypertension, 3 months of cannabis use in mainly oil, and this was associated with a reduction in systolic and diastolic blood pressure, as well as their heart rate reduced and their resting pulse pressure reduced. So these older adults were able to begin reducing their uses of blood pressure medicines.
How much of it would you have to consume for it to have a large enough reduction?
Dosage does matter. We're seeing that cannabis is interesting because it has what we call a biphasic effect. Low doses provide one effect, whereas high doses provide a completely different effect. For instance, using THC, obviously, in high amounts is going to cause a tachycardia and a blood pressure effect. As the tachycardia increases, the blood pressure drops. Whereas in lower doses, it actually will not cause that effect, and it will actually have a cardioprotective effect. Cannabis is the only type of compound that does this. This would be analogous to you have one Tylenol for pain or you have five Tylenol for pain. But this does this all in one dosage in relation to the type of cannabinoid you want to use. In one study that you can find on clinicaltrials.gov in 2023 by Dujic, D-U-J-I-C, for anyone interested in checking it out, this is a very recent study in 2023 on hypertension where they looked at chronic CBD administration on a 24-hour blood pressure and arterial stiffness. Arterial stiffness is just what it sounds like. The arteries are so stiff because of the fibrous atherosclerotic plaques that they don't expand, they don't dilate appropriately, and therefore they don't move very well. This is where we begin to develop the stenosis, the narrowing of that artery. So they looked at these hypertensive patients for over 5 weeks of oral CBD use, and in the first 2.5 weeks, they took a range, either 225 to 300 milligrams split over 3 times a day. After that 2.5 weeks, they upped it to 375 to 450 milligrams split over 3 times a day. So averaging out to maybe a little over around 100 to 200 milligrams 3 times a day. They wanted to see what this large dose could be, but obviously 450 milligrams was still not a very large dose in relation to what it could be. We do know that 6,000 milligrams is the max you'll want to give of CBD any day. After just 2.5 weeks of either one of these doses, from the 225 to 300 milligrams split over 3 times a day, just after 2.5 weeks, it reduced the average 24-hour blood pressure mean, systolic, and diastolic blood pressures. Just after 2.5 weeks of using it 3 times a day. Their values remained stable after they moved to the second higher doses, meaning that higher doses are not necessarily better, meaning that we can stay at that 225 to 300 milligram dose and 3 times a day, and it would still give you beneficial effects in relation to your blood pressure. They also assessed liver enzymes. This is one of the concerns because we do know that CBD will compete for liver enzymes. And they wanted to make sure that this was something safe and there were no changes in their liver enzymes. And they reduced their ambulatory blood pressure in both populations that had treated and untreated blood pressure medications. They kept both of these populations in this study to see, will there either be any drug-drug interactions between the CBD and the blood pressure medicines? Will there be a difference? Will it create either no effect or will it create even more more lowering the blood pressure effect? Would there be what we call an additive effect? No, there wasn't any effect. This particular reduction just in 2.5 weeks reduced and kept it low in both populations of those who were taking blood pressure medicines and those who were not. Safe, non-toxic, non-impairing, and the anecdotes related to this in my store have been right on, because people come in and ask, what can I use to get off my blood pressure medicines? Because I'm like on a boatload of them now. and none of them are working. And I just, they want me to take more. And I don't know how I can take more blood pressure medicines. I'm already taking as many as I want to. Help. Help.
What's the process for weaning somebody off of a blood pressure medication and then on to using some sort of CBD product as a replacement?
That's a great question, because we don't want anybody to just stop their medications, period. You should always be consulting. The patients should always be consulting with their prescriber, the person who knows them best and who prescribed that medicine for them for that whatever medical condition they needed. So they always need to complain to their physicians or their practitioners that they are interested in using these medicines. And we know that President Biden, of course, the national law that was signed into effect just a year ago, the Medical Marijuana and Cannabidiol Research Expansion Act, which allows physicians to even just discuss cannabis.
You can be honest now.
That's right. You want to be open and honest and talk, have these discussions. We do know, obviously, from these types of trials, the one here I just talked about at clinical.trials.gov, we do know that even in the presence of some of these medications, that the effect is still beneficial and it is not risky, because what are we doing? CBD is stimulating the cannabinoid 2 receptor in the endocannabinoid system that does what? It is helping your body balance any types of problems and conditions. Remember, the difference is that CB2 is not found in pathological states. So when you upregulate it in pathological states, it's trying to tell the body, help me, there's something I need here. And the things that stimulate CB2 receptors are not THC. It does not stimulate the CB2 receptor like it stimulates the CB1 receptor. So when we want to agonize, or we want to stimulate, evoke a response, a stimulus from the CB2 receptor, the primary one to do that with is CBD. CBD for the win.
So let's say that you have high blood pressure and you're using CBD to treat that. You could simultaneously be treating 5 other things by using CBD.
The side effects of CBD is that you get well in other areas too.
Right. It's like, it's a super drug.
It's the super green, super beets. It's the super drug. Another interesting thing coming out about CBD is from a study done in just 2023 by Teichmann. This particular group was looking at how do multiple compounds stimulate or affect cardiovascular systems in the body. CBD showed potent anti-inflammatory effects by reducing high glucose-induced inflammation in coronary artery and endothelial cells. And it also induced an endothelium-dependent vascular relaxation in the mesenteric arteries. The mesenteric arteries are those arteries of the gut that are providing blood supply to the arterioles or all the tissues in the gut. So CBD, there's your side effect. As we're giving it, it also reduces the inflammation associated with high glucose. What typically goes together is diabetes, metabolic syndrome, and hypertension, because there's inflammation in the heart. This particular group also researched a concerning cardiovascular disorder known as pulmonary hypertension. Pulmonary hypertension is different than what we would think of as, you know, standard hypertension, in that the pulmonary artery that's supplying blood from the body, the pulmonary artery is collecting and taking blood coming back from the body and delivering it first through the right chamber of the heart and then into the lungs. That's where the oxygenation and carbon dioxide exchanges are taking place. So the pulmonary artery is both delivering bad blood back to your heart while pumping it through the lungs to be reoxygenated to deliver it to the rest of the body. So when we look at pulmonary arterial hypertension, this becomes a very bad condition over time. And this particular study shown that CBD lessened pulmonary arterial hypertension by inhibiting the proliferation of pulmonary smooth muscle cells and reducing inflammation with them. So even in a very extreme condition like pulmonary arterial hypertension, we can see reductions in blood pressure just by using CBD.
What about CBG? Cannabigerol?
Cannabigerol is quickly becoming my favorite drug in the in the cannabis plant. CBG is a wonder drug. I'm thinking that CBG is going to be showing so many different properties because of its anti-inflammatory effects. We're finding that CBG is actually more potent than steroids as an anti-inflammatory. And because heart disease is mainly driven in inflammation in tissues, CBG can actually work as an anti-inflammatory to reduce the amount of that arterial stiffness by preventing plaque formation. CBG is also a potent alpha-2 adrenergic agonist. This is a form of stimulation in the heart that actually creates a heart effect, a tachycardic effect, the alpha-2 adrenergic receptor. We actually have an adrenergic receptor agonist known as clonidine. And when you have patients that may have blood pressure problems that are not responsive to other types of antihypertensives like beta blockers or vasodilators or calcium channel blockers, alpha-2 adrenergic agonists were very popular for that reason, is that they were an alternative way. We found, however, that they didn't have very many benefits over using the other drugs, so we kind of steered away from them. But it doesn't matter. When you stimulate the alpha-2 adrenergic receptor, it actually will affect receptors located in the vascular endothelium. So alpha-2 stimulation reduces blood pressure in the blood vessels, specifically by allowing it to decrease inflammation, which then not only reduces blood pressure, but when you reduce inflammation, you are also at the same time reducing the risk of atherosclerosis development.
I was looking at the Wikipedia page for cannabigerol. Someone needs to update the Wikipedia page for cannabigerol, because it says, as of 2021, no clinical research has been conducted to test the specific effects of cannabigerol in humans. Well, that has changed.
Absolutely. That's why I don't let my students use Wikipedia
this
as a reference.
This is why we shouldn't trust Wikipedia. Right.
Another effect of CBG in the body is that it actually has been shown to inhibit primary and secondary platelet aggregation. Platelet aggregation is clot aggregation. Clots are why people who have heart attacks or have had strokes or have had maybe even joint replacement surgery, this is why they're on anticoagulant medications. CBG does the same thing by inhibiting the development of the aggregation, meaning that it prevents the clots from sticking to each other. But this is another reason why you need to be discussing this with your patients or with your educators in healthcare, because if somebody is on an anticoagulant, we're going to need to know that, because we need to monitor that platelet aggregation, because CBG now in the mix will also add to that anticoagulant effect. There are some reasons that you would want to clot. Right? When you cut yourself, definitely want to clot yourself, but you don't want to be too unclotty, too anticoagulated, too blood thinned, that there's a danger. And it seems that adding CBG will actually reduce your risks of blood clots. Another way that it can be very heart healthy. We also know, we've talked about the stress, anxiety that could potentially create tachycardia. And if you got a blood pressure problem related to stress or anxiety, CBG binds to another receptor known as the serotonin receptor. In clinical land, we call this the 5-HT1A receptor, but serotonin is what we call our happy neurotransmitter. Serotonin is our mood balancer. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the SSRIs, are found in anti-anxiety and antidepressant land. So when we stimulate this serotonin receptor with CBG, we create a reflex in the cardiovascular system by calming our feelings of anxiety, by balancing our mood. And that, of course, has an effect on the heart by helping the heart rate stay normal and the blood pressure remain at rest.
A two-pronged approach.
CBG just has so many side effects, like it prevents blood clotting, it reduces inflammation in the heart, it relaxes you and allows your body to be balanced.
When you say side effect, you mean a good effect.
That's
because sometimes
right.
People think when you say side effect, it's automatically bad.
And everyone associates cannabis with bad, because No one, until date, well, of course, here's Wikipedia, has really understood how the other cannabinoids can function as a drug of wellness in the body. If we don't use THC and we use compounds like CBD and CBG, we're now finding that they have so many beneficial effects related to the cardiovascular system. But we have a whole universe of cannabinoids that we're about to study for the cardiovascular and other conditions. CBC. CBC stands for cannabichromene. Cannabichromene is one of the many cannabinoids that we can find in the cannabis plant. And CBC in studies was found to produce a very good positive hypotensive effect, which means that when you lower your blood pressure with a hypotensive effect, we want to keep that sustained. And they found that it was very beneficial when you give CBC with THC. It prevents that tachycardia associated with the THC administration. This is significant because we're finding that just like the cannabinoids are combined in the plant, there's a reason behind that. We have been looking at them in isolation in some studies, but we're finding that this entourage effect, this mixing of the cannabinoids to counter offset maybe concerns or risks, or avoiding them altogether by using microdoses of the concerning compound, THC, are actually where we can begin to lessen the risks associated with it. Using THCV, this is another cannabinoid that we're going to have its own podcast about in the future, tetrahydrocannabivarin. This is anti-weed. This is an anti-effect. And actually, THCV is a CB1 antagonist, meaning that it does not stimulate or it blocks stimulation of the CB1 receptor. Again, another cannabinoid that if we give it with THC, we can potentially reduce the THC-induced heart rate without having any other adverse effects. CBD is known to do this. When my medical marijuana patients were complaining about feeling too high, there was nothing I could do in the very beginning, but research rolled out that showed that when we give CBD with THC, it lessens the impairing, intoxicating effects. THC being the main problem is where we want to prevent the risks associated with using cannabis. We're back to using CBD for another condition, atherosclerosis, because hypertension and atherosclerosis go together. In a study by Rorabaugh, and this is done just in 2023, they wanted to see what CBD and stimulation of that CB2 receptor would do. This study showed that CBD and stimulation of the CB2 receptor exerted a protective effect against atherosclerosis. It stopped the inflammation in those smooth muscle cells of the blood vessels, and this is where you begin to develop those pro-inflammatory effects that create the fibrin development, the stiffness in the artery, then the stenosis. Then as the blood vessel continues to remodel, meaning that it's not making healthy cells, it's now growing more of the fibrin atherosclerotic plaques, this is where we develop the disease known as atherosclerosis. It's especially concerning in the coronary arteries as the blood becomes less available to oxygenate the coronary heart tissues. So CBD and using these compounds can actually prevent and lower blood pressure, as well as atherosclerosis. CBG is also known to lower atherosclerosis plaque in the arteries because, again, CBG is a very potent anti-inflammatory. We now have a lot of data, especially retrospective data, across the country as dispensaries in legal states have opened up, and we're able to now look at, actually, I should say we were able to include questions about marijuana, questions about cannabis on national studies now. But we're now looking retrospectively back into the data. This study came out in 2023 by Karoon. This was from data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and it looked at data from 2009 to 2018. Over 9 years, they looked at almost 10,000 individuals who responded that they did use cannabis at least monthly for over a year. And they wanted to look at the relationship between those who had experienced an MI in that time to see if there were any correlation to using cannabis at the same time. They found that there were no associations of a history of self-reported physician-diagnosed MI with their cannabis use. This population was interesting because those that admitted to cannabis use were typically more male. They also smoked cigarettes. So they're now in the category where there's a confounding variable called tobacco smoke. They drank more alcohol. Now we're talking substance use in general. They had more likely to be substance users. And they had a greater 10-year risk for developing cardiovascular disease. But this population also was found to engage in more physical activity. Huh. And because of that, they had a more favorable BMI, body mass index, which means that they weighed less. And they also had lower concentrations of selected lipid biomarkers. These are your fat biomarkers like cholesterol, total cholesterol, triglycerides, LDLs. They had better glycemic parameters as well, meaning that their blood sugars were typically under control within their normal limits. So the outcome of this national study that tried to correlate cannabis use with heart attacks saw that in a representative sample of middle-aged U.S. adults, a history of monthly cannabis use for more than a year before an MI was not linked to a subsequent physician-diagnosed MI after controlling for other cardiovascular risk factors. They also found that when considering recent use, meaning those that had used it and admitted it within 30 days, the odds were three times greater that they did not have an MI if they reported use more distally, meaning more than nine months later, but they didn't use it for a while. They were more likely to have a heart attack during that time. This goes back to the cardiovascular system's protective effects associated with the endocannabinoid system. It seems that certain compounds are going to provide a cardiovascular protective effect. A limitation of this study was that the only effects that were measured were smoking. The survey hasn't evolved to include different types of modalities now. But again, that is almost to our favor as an outcome, because even in these smoking populations, there was not an associated risk of having a heart attack in this long chronic use over 9 years in this survey. In another study by Demizio in 2023, CBD was used in a MI model. They looked at how CBD was influencing the after effects of the heart attack. They found that CBD caused a reduction of infarct size. When you have a heart attack, the reason that you have the heart attack is those cardiac cells in the heart die immediately due to lack of oxygen. And lack of oxygen typically comes from a blood clot or a stenosis that prevents blood from getting to that site to deliver oxygen. So that's called the infarct. Those are dead tissues, the dead cells. CBD in this study actually reduced the infarct size. It allowed reductions in cardiac inflammation, and it also reduced the inflammatory markers that would cause inflammation. This is, again, part of the inflammatory problem that we have once an injury like a heart attack occurs in the cells. The body responds by sending inflammation cells and then immune cells. And that's where you start to develop your fibrinous plaques in the arteries, or your fibrous or other dysfunctions in the cells.
So what does this all mean? What do we do?
We need to first educate our population, especially our healthcare providers, that all of the compounds have effects on the cardiovascular system. Some are good, some are bad. The way that you use them and the way that they interact and the types of repair are the most important thing. So education at the most basic level should be rolled out to our practitioners to understand, especially our prescribers. The next thing is that every patient encounter, you should be screening for cannabis use, especially in the populations of the older adults. Those are the ones that are more than likely going to be on concurrent blood pressure medicines and anti-cholesterol medicines and maybe other heart failure medicines. We need to screen our population to make sure that they understand that there are risks. And if we avoid THC smoking, it seems that those risks are very minimal. We want to counsel them on how to get the safest effect from the lowest dose. We're seeing in study after study that our practice of cannabis as medicine is ruled really by very simple tenets. One of the first tenets of cannabis as medicine is that you start at the lowest dose. Then over time, as the body begins to respond to the cannabinoids, you can then begin to work to achieve a beneficial effect. But once that beneficial effect is developed, you stay at the lowest dose. Start low, go slow, and stay low is our mantra. And we are showing in study after study that keeping low doses of even maybe THC may have beneficial effects, especially in the cardiovascular system.
She's Dr. Denise Foster. It's Cannabis Nurse Truths, and we'll be back next Wednesday with another episode right here wherever you get your podcasts. We are on iTunes. We're on Spotify, Google Play, iHeartRadio, whatever app you use. Search for Cannabis Nurse Truths or just go to the website, cannabisnursetruths.com. And don't forget to follow us on social media. We are on X at Canna Podcast, CannaPotcast. I'm Lee Foster, Dr. Denise Foster. Thank you as always, and we'll talk to you again next week.